No, this is practical and real. I'm going to have great consultations with Mr. Garth. He can tell me almost everything I want to know.
Then you will be happy if you have a plan. Perhaps little Arthur will like plans when he grows up, and then he can help you. Really, Dorothea, taking off your cap has made you just like your old self again.
And the story continues on Monday afternoon. Middlemarch by George Eliot was dramatised by Judith Adams, and in today's episode you heard Caroline Martin, Richard Delane, Carl Johnson, Nick Fletcher, Candida Benson, Sally Dexter, Tom Goodman Hill, Catherine Igo, Nicholas Murchie, Laura Doddington, Martin Hyder and Elizabeth Garvey.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Fliss worries she'll never be forgiven, while Lottie reels at news from her past. The final part of Wedding Night, our book at Beach Time, is in 15 minutes. Before that, a former book of the week, Family Britain by David Kynaston and read by Dominic West. It tells the vivid and intimate story of Britain in the 1950s, drawing on the letters, diaries and memories of well-known and ordinary people. In episode 5, A Pretty Mess, an increasingly affluent and confident Britain is rocked by the Suez crisis.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen.
Terrible 24 hours, noted the Prime Minister's wife, Clarissa Eden, on 27th of July 1956. NASA trying to take over the Suez Canal. Anthony and the cabinet decide to fight, if necessary, alone. It was a concise, accurate summary, and most of the press over the next few days agreed that Britain could not allow this to pass unchallenged, and the Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell laid such stress on NASA as a 1930s-style dictator that he appeared to be giving support to Eden's firm line. Away from Westminster and Fleet Street, as the Army Reserve was called up and Royal Navy ships sent to the Middle East, it was Billy Butlin who had his finger on the popular pulse, refusing to allow Egypt's brilliant swimmers to participate in the annual Butlin's Cross-Channel Swimming Race. "They've got the Suez Canal," he was quoted as saying. "I'm not going to let them have the English Channel." Between early August and late October, amidst endless rounds of diplomacy, largely a charade from the British Tory government's point of view, Suez's position steadily hardened. In the press, there was majority support, but not overwhelmingly so, for the Eden line about the folly of a rerun of interwar appeasement. And in the public at large, polls revealed a deep mistrust and disapproval of NASA, but a preference at this stage for going down the UN route rather than taking unilateral action. The pace of events quickened during October. A meeting at the Paris suburb of Sèvres on the 22nd saw Britain, France and Israel cooking up an astonishingly disreputable, highly secret scheme. They decided that a week later, Israel would invade Egypt, thereby enabling an Anglo-French intervention that could be presented as peacemaking, while in reality seeking to regain the canal and in the process overthrow NASA. If not quite something out of Blackadder, it was not much better. On the evening of Monday the 29th, as Israeli tanks and armoured cars duly crossed Egyptian border outposts and headed for the Suez Canal, the Queen was attending the royal film performance of the Battle of the River Plate at the Empire in Leicester Square. There she was presented to a galaxy of stars, including the three leading sex symbols of the day, Marilyn Monroe, Brigitte Bardot, and Anita Ekberg. "Marilyn Monroe captures Britain," was one headline next day. But on the set of The Prince and the Showgirl at Pinewood, things were getting tricky, as Colin Clark, a junior technician, observed.
"The trouble is that MM takes extra pills when she doesn't feel 100%. Without really knowing what effect the pills will have. She looks more and more vulnerable, and I am sorry for her, but one of the exasperated lighting men, a veteran of countless rank films, told me that if it wasn't for his loyalty to Sir Lawrence, he'd have edged a spanner off the grid and onto her head."
The next afternoon, Eden stunned the Commons by announcing an Anglo-French ultimatum to NASA, who was given 12 hours to withdraw his troops from the Suez Canal or face the consequences. The Tories roared their delight. Everywhere there seemed discord and division. "This Suez business is setting men by the ears," reflected Kenneth Preston in Keighley, adding that in the staff room at his grammar school there was a sharp cleavage of opinions. Another disconcerted person this Friday was the undergraduate Brian Thompson.
"I joined an anti-war protest march that was forming up outside the Cambridge Labour Club. An old man tottered out of the premises, reversed his walking stick and struck me a nerve-numbing blow on the arm. 'Not a soldier among you,' he shouted, beside himself with rage."
RAF Rock and Roll 'em Round the Clock was the front page headline of the luridly tabloid Daily Sketch on Saturday the 3rd, and the report started, "The last remnants of Colonel Nasser's Air Force lay in smouldering ruins in the desert dust last night." Three papers in the other camp, Manchester Guardian, News Chronicle and Daily Mirror, all noted bulging post bags running heavily against Eden's action, though both viewpoints were represented, as in the Mirror.
"When I heard of the bombing on the news this morning, I said to my husband, 'We don't want war. What can we do about it?' And his reply frightened me. 'There is nothing we can do about it. We voted the government into power and it's their policy we have to abide by,' he said. 'I've never written to a newspaper before and I have no political affiliations, though I voted Tory last time, but I can remember the horror of the last war. There must be some way of stopping Eden.' Mrs. E.H., Windsor."
"Thank heaven at last this country is going to stop being pushed around by all and sundry. Old Eighth Army rats welcome the news that we are landing to protect the Suez, despite the cowardly bleats of the socialists." J.M. Barnett, Hearts.
On Sunday morning, the most celebrated and execrated editorial on the Suez crisis appeared. "The action against Egypt," asserted the Observer, "endangered the American alliance and NATO, split the Commonwealth, flouted the United Nations, shocked the overwhelming majority of world opinion, and dishonoured the name of Britain." This made an appropriate appetizer to the main event of the day, a mass Stop the War rally in Trafalgar Square, attended by at least 10,000, with many holding aloft "Law Not War" banners. The main speaker was Aneurin Bevan, whose beautifully delivered put-down would be deservedly remembered for years. "If Sir Anthony is sincere in what he says, and he may be, then he's too stupid to be Prime Minister." After the demo, in the early evening, several thousand surged down Whitehall and headed for ungated Downing Street, where an apprehensive cabinet was in session, only to be blocked by mounted police. On Monday in the West End, the shock news came through at about 4 o'clock that in view of the international situation, Buckingham Palace had requested the cancellation of this evening's Royal Command variety show.
"I just cannot believe it's true,"
declared a distraught Sabrina, who had been due to sing Temptation, backed by the Nitwits.
"And there was I, insisting that they made the neck of my dress higher so that no one should protest about my appearance. I don't know what to say."
Still, there were plenty of alternative attractions that evening. Marilyn Monroe's film Bus Stop was in the cinemas, Tommy Steele gave his first major live performance at the Sunderland Empire, and in Gravesend, Anthony Wedgwood Benn addressed 3 protest meetings, though the poor turnout rather confirmed what he had suspected, that ordinary people were not yet very moved on the issue. But there was another huge problem looming for Eden. During Cabinet the next morning, Harold Macmillan as Chancellor outlined the severe pressure that Britain's financial reserves were now under, and the unwillingness of the Americans to come to the rescue by offering dollar loans. Macmillan concluded that in economic terms, there was no alternative but to end the military action. Accordingly, a consensus emerged that a ceasefire would be announced later in the day. Eden duly did so in the Commons in the late afternoon, to resounding cheers from the Tories behind him. One of them said aloud, "What exactly are we cheering?" recorded Anthony Wedgwood Benn. The flamboyant MP Gerald Nabarro, who was beside him, exclaimed in a stage whisper, "We're cheering the last chance to save our political bacon, old boy. That's what we're cheering, and make no mistake about it." Nor were these easy times for many other people. Days before Eden left for 3 weeks' much-criticised recuperation in Jamaica, it was announced that petrol rationing would start in mid-December, with a weekly maximum allowance of 200 miles for private motorists. This was to lead directly to the creation of a new, fuel-efficient car, the Mini. Then on the 3rd of December, there were two further announcements, that the British forces would be withdrawing from Egypt, and the tax on petrol would rise by 40%. American journalist Virginia Graham, writing to Joyce Grenfell, reflected the gloomy public mood.
"News-wise, it's altogether a wretched Wednesday morn. Petrol up to 6 shillings a gallon, bread going up, dollar reserves down a whump, and a promise of increased income tax. Suez really does seem to have been a disastrous enterprise. And even my Tony, who has been staunchly pro-Eden, is beginning to feel it wasn't quite the most brilliant idea he ever had."
3 days later in the chamber, Eden himself explicitly denied collusion. "I want to say this on the question of foreknowledge, and to say it quite bluntly to the House, that there was not foreknowledge that Israel would attack Egypt. There was not." It was a crisis that had shown many things. Britain's inability to act independently of her American ally, the futility of clinging on to illusions of empire, the ability of those in power to practice deceit, with the extent of the collusion not definitively emerging until well into the 1960s, and an undeniable waning of deference, symbolised by the Trafalgar Square demonstration. But how much impact did it really have on people at the time? At the very height of the crisis, journalist Molly Panter Downs, in her regular London newsletter in The New Yorker, noted that,
"Through all the shaking events and bewilderment of the past week, London has seemed a city of preternaturally calm people who pause in the street corners to buy their papers and stand there a minute to stare at the headlines with a total lack of expression before tucking the things under their arms and marching on."
Nothing, after all, had let up in the distracting national pageant. 2 weeks after the ceasefire, filming complete, Marilyn Monroe flew out of London Airport, telling reporters that meeting your queen had been her biggest thrill. "I didn't manage to get any of your fish and chips," her biggest disappointment. At the Royal Albert Hall, Fanny and Johnny Craddock had their hour in the sun in front of an audience of 6,500 and the television cameras, presenting the Bon Viveur International Christmas Cookery Show, sponsored by the North Thames Gas Board. It turned out to be, more than ever before, a TV Christmas. On the genuine grounds of ill health, Eden resigned on Wednesday the 9th of January. It's a moot point whether he really had a political future, but the striking fact was that, at the point of resignation, 56% of the public were, according to Gallup, still satisfied with him. "The Queen sends for Macmillan," announced the Evening Standard in its final night extra the next evening. But tucked away on an inside page, its news briefs column was a pleasing reminder of the permanence of the local and particular.
15 budgerigars offered to Free and Barnet Council have been refused. Reason, no aviary. "The Queen has sent a donation towards a new church on a housing estate at King's Lynn. Police have been asked by Harrow Council to watch for hooligans smashing street lamps. Complaints of increased noise due to shunting at North Chingford are being investigated."
For most people, the future was indisputably modern, yet modern, they hoped, within a familiar, reassuring setting. Modernists, by contrast, had little patience with the recalcitrant forces of social conservatism. The tensions between these two perspectives, one glancing anxiously over the shoulder at a disappearing past, the other forging ever onwards and upwards, would be played out in modernity Britain.
The fifth and final part of Family Britain was read by Dominic West, with Madeline Brolly, Emily Bevan, Matt Fraser and Nigel Coombs. The producer was Jane Greenwood. Well, Ambridge Extra continues to tell the stories from beyond the village. And after Lillian's betrayal, Matt decides to pursue business abroad. But are his emotions clouding his judgment?
And what about Amside?
What about it? It's your business.
No, it's not. It still needs both of us.
You're the director.
You can't just turn your back on it now. It's our business.
No.
If you carry on like this...
It can manage without me.
It can't, Matt. I can't.
Oh, then maybe you should have thought of that before you slept with my brother.
The Ambridge Extra Omnibus is on Sunday morning at 11:15, and the story continues on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 2:15.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Jack Shepherd stars in our 60-minute drama at 3 o'clock. It's Bright Day by J.B. Priestley. Before that, it's our Book at Beach Time. A special season of readings for the summer continues with the next instalment of Sophie Kinsella's new bestseller about the romantic misadventures of two sisters. Lottie is regretting her marriage but can see no way out. Will Fliss arrive in time to save the day? Further romantic complications await the two sisters.
Book at Beach Time. Wedding Night by Sophie Kinsella. Part 5.
I don't like my husband. It's like a clanging in my ears, a death knell. I have made a monumental, humongous, terrifying mistake. I have an instinctive, desperate longing for Fliss, but at the same time I realise I can never, never admit this to her. I'll have to stay married to Ben and pretend everything's okay till the end of my days. I feel homesick. Homesick for Richard. I feel as though when we split up, he wrenched a bit of my heart out. My whole body's throbbing with the pain, and it's nowhere near healing. I miss him. I miss his humour. I miss the feel of him in bed. I miss catching his eye at a party and knowing we're thinking the same thing. I miss his voice and his kisses. And I'm married to someone else. It's nearly an hour before I move. I jump down from the rock, dust myself off, and head swiftly towards the guest house. Ben didn't bother trying to find me to see if I was all right, I note. I see them before they see me. Ben is sitting close to Sarah on the veranda, his hand curled around her shoulders and playing lightly with her strap. It's so obvious what's been going on, I feel like screaming. I creep towards the guest house, staying silent as a cat. Kiss, I'm willing them. Kiss. Confirm what I secretly believe. Sarah's laughing at something Ben is saying, and he's playing with her hair now. And they've got that intense, couple-y look going on, and... Houston, we have touchdown. Their lips have fixed together. I march towards the veranda, feeling like a soap opera actress who's slightly late for her cue. How could you? They leap apart. Ben, we need to talk.
Yes.
Sarah tactfully disappears into the guest house and I join Ben on the veranda. It's difficult to say this. I blink back tears. But I think our marriage was too quick. I think we rushed. And I blame myself. I'd only recently come out of a relationship. It was too soon. I spread my hands. My bad. Sorry.
No, says Ben at once. My bad.
There's silence as I take his words in. So we both think it was a mistake. Shall we tell Yorgo to cancel the honeymoon album then? I give a snort of almost painful laughter. I feel strangely detached. This is surreal. My marriage is over before it's begun. I look at him properly. Was this marriage ever real to you?
Oh, I don't know, he winces. Nothing's felt real to me these last few years. My dad dying, the company. I think I need to sort this out. He bangs his head with his fist. It wasn't real for me either. It was like a fantasy. I was in such a bad place and you pitched up and you look so hot. Ben looks at his phone. I have to go back to the hotel. I have this meeting with Yuri Zernikov. He's sailed here especially to see me. Wow. I know. He puffs himself out a bit. I want to sell. It makes sense. Lorcan thinks I shouldn't, which makes it an even better reason to do it. For a while I'm silent. I might be keeping it together in front of Ben, but inside I feel battered by everything. Everything I thought is upside down. My marriage is over. I started the fire. Fail, fail, fail.